This is Duncan Boston, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 7th of June 2012. Duncan Boston, Part 1.
George Duncan Boston, born in Wakefield in West Yorkshire on the 3rd of June 1933.
So you're now 70?
79.
What was your father's occupation?
He was a head porter at the local hospital.
An educated man?
No. Only self-educated. He was a clever man, but like many people of his generation, had very little formal schooling.
What about your schooling, Duncan?
Local primary school, then on to a direct grammar school on scholarships. Then apprenticeship with the National Coal Board, where I took mechanical engineering qualifications. Then national service.
With the RAF, is that right?
With the RAF, yeah. And then I decided to change tack, leave engineering and went back to college, decided to be a teacher.
So did engineering run in the family, is that how
No. It was, after I'd taken my school certificate, in those days scholarships ended. You were considered to be educated. And we were pretty poor. And that I needed to earn money. So my father got me what he thought was a good job. I suppose in a sense it was. I mean, the National Coal Board were very good employers, particularly to their apprentices, particularly if, like myself, had been at grammar school, you were seen as staff potential. So they saw you got an extremely good technical education, day release and that sort of thing, to the local technical college.
When was the first inkling you had then that there might be a place on a planet called the Antarctic?
Oh, very early on. I was a very enthusiastic student of geography when I was at school, and I also had a very, very good geography teacher. So I was pretty au fait with the maps of the world. I was also a very enthusiastic reader and user of the local library. And I can remember as a pretty small boy lying on the rug in front of the fire, reading a children's edition of Scott of the Antarctic, The Great Journey, with tears falling down my face. And I thought, you know what, such brave men, I would like to go there. Little thinking that, you know, it might be possible. But I must have only been 6 or 7 years old then.
What was causing the tears, do you think?
That's such a moving story.
You know. Because he died, you mean?
Well, because they all died, but after making such phenomenal efforts, and I was very conscious that they were, you know, the Captain Oates story was, to a boy, very, very moving. Yeah. Still makes me weep, to be honest.
So that kind of went into the brain cells and stayed
there?
Oh,
very much so, yeah. Very much so.
So when was the first suggestion in your life that you might be able to go where he went?
Oh, when I became a climbing is what opened up my mind.
Tell me about that.
Which I discovered. Well, again, through reading, I discovered the books of Frank Smythe. And I think before I ever thought about actually going climbing myself, I think I'd read every single one of Frank Smythe's books. Then I got the idea this would be a jolly good thing to do. This is when I'm still at school. And I set about persuading someone to go climbing with me. I realised I didn't really know very much about it, how you do it or what you do it with. I realised you needed a companion or companions. And I eventually persuaded three rather reluctant companions from the grammar school to go to Ilkley on Monday, which was probably the nearest known crag. I remember one of them particularly inappropriate because he was a boy called Philip Mickman, who was actually quite famous because he'd been the youngest person at the time ever to swim the English Channel, and he was built like a true channel swimmer, was Philip. But he was a very amiable chap. So Philip found himself jammed in this rock chimney with me on a very wet day. I thought the whole experience was wonderful on this wet day on the rock. But none of the other three ever came again with me.
What was the attraction? Was it the physicalness of climbing, or the joy of getting to the top?
Oh, the physicality of it, I think. The physicality. And very quickly, the comradeship of climbing. You've got to be close to people to climb with them. And that's the thing that remains with me to this day, the companionship.
It's the interdependence, isn't it?
Yes.
Which I presume came in handy later in the Antarctic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm. But, I mean, at that time, once I found Klein, I wasn't really thinking about the Antarctic. I was just thinking, well, A, about school, which was still central to my life. What I was going to do when I left school, because by this time I realised I was doing okay at school. I took my school certificate, as it was then, a year early. I had my school certificate when I was only 14. And though the scholarships technically ran out at school certificate, they ran out when you were 15. Mm. So I did get a year in sixth form, at which time I definitely got the idea I'd like to go to university. That was not to be then.
What was the problem? Finance?
Oh, finance. Oh, yeah. A common thing. I mean, the school I went to, pretty well all high... The scholarship boys were all high flyers. Could mention lots of names like David Story and Frank Laycock and people, composer. Went to some pretty bright lads. But most of them had to leave school when they were 15. I mean, David Story famously wrote his book about playing rugby because he became a professional rugby player when he left school. And then, of course, a playwright. But it wasn't unusual. But I had hoped for something better than going to work down the pit, which is a pit in West Yorkshire, is a fairly normal route, but not one to be envied. One learnt to accept what life threw at you in those days. And it threw the coal board to me, which I hated, I must say. But I stuck it out and got my national and higher national, which qualified me for some pretty good jobs after that, except I didn't like it very much. Mm.
What interrupted the teaching career then, because you were settling on the job?
Oh, that came much later.
Oh, did it?
Teaching. Yeah.
After the Antarctic?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about the transition from National Coal Board to British Antarctic, or to FIDS, as it was then.
I've completed my national service. I completed my apprenticeship and got my qualifications and went into the RAF. And I had hoped to learn to fly. This was the goal then. And... the RAF welcomed me. Oh, my God, just the sort of chap we need to fly. And packed me off to aircrew selection down at Hornchurch, which I loved. Oh, it was great, was that. So I was there for, I think it was a month. And passed with flying colours. I thought, hey, here we go. Where's my Spitfire? But then came the interview and they said, well, yes, you're just the sort of chap we're looking for. You passed everything with flying colours, excellent. Would you like to just sign this, this being to sign on for full-time in the Air Force for 8 years? And I said, oh, no, I'm not signing on. Because I knew, in fact, they did train National Service pilots, quite a lot of them, in fact. But they were always in batches, and my timing was not very good.
Oh, I see.
And so I said, nope. They said, well, sign up for 3 years and you could be a navigator. I said, no, I want to be a pilot. So that was a big disappointment, but I just refused to sign on.
Have you ever regretted that decision?
Oh, often.
You have?
Often. I've often wondered what would have happened if I'd signed on. Because I had two good climbing friends who did the National Service about the same time as me. And they had no hesitation in signing on, learnt to fly, and then made the transition after their 8 years into commercial flying. And both of them, you know, spent the rest of their life flying aeroplanes, you know, fairly lucratively. But there we are. We all have to make these choices. And But that's all they ever did.
Yes.
Exactly. None of them ever carried on the climbing. I mean, the climbing ended when they went in the Air Force, whereas I'm still climbing.
So how did you then come to...
Oh, well, right, I'm a national serviceman, and having not signed on, I then just did my own job as a general engineer in the Air Force, quite close to home, actually, RAF Leeming, which meant I could get away every weekend and carry on climbing every weekend, so that was all good. It was whilst I was doing my national service, I started thinking about, do I really want to be an engineer for the rest of my life? And the answer was no. So I talked to the education officers in the at RAF Leeming, and they said, well, if you want to be a teacher, there's absolutely no reason why not. Your educational qualification is good. You know, any university or teacher training college will take you. So my mind was working that way. But it was a big step to take because when I came out of the RAF, I got a job with a big American firm called Foster Wheeler as a site engineer, building power stations. And this was a good job, you know, it was extremely well paid. I've never been as well paid since. And my mother was so pleased that her little lad now had a proper job with a car and everything. But it's not right. If I'm going to move, I've got to do it. So I wrote to three northern universities and said, I don't know how you do it, you know, but I'd really like to be a teacher and I'd like to come to university to get a degree. And within, they all answered more or less by return and said, certainly, you're now a mature student. You can come any time you like. Which is all a bit surprising. So then I had to think about the money. Fortunately, my father, you asked earlier about my father. My father, what his life was, local politics. All the time he was a hospital porter. He was also leader of the Labour Party in Wakefield, mayor several times over. His life was public life. And I think he put in a good word for me, and the education department said that they'd give me a grant to go. So that was taken care of. So the next thing I know was packing my suitcase and going off to something else I'd absolutely no idea about at Liverpool University. Which I must admit was a bit of a disappointment in some respect. I thought it would be, you know, intellectually very, very demanding. And it really wasn't. So I was able to devote my time to other things which were a novelty to me, like lots and lots of girls around. I mean, having worked down the pit, you don't meet a lot of girls. But in the Air Force, there were no WAFs around in RAF Leeming. That was quite interesting. And I started playing rugby again, which I'd played at school, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I had a pretty good time at university. But I didn't think it was very intellectually demanding. But whilst I was there, my prof, the geography guy...
Do you remember his name?
He was... Oh, gosh. Do you know, I was trying to think of that this morning.
Don't worry.
I'll find it out for you and let you know later. Or it will probably just sail into my head in an hour or so. He rather took me under his wing because I was very keen on geography. And having been around the world a bit, you know, through climbing, we got on like a house on fire. And he was also a very, very good teacher himself. Anyway, he produced a little cutting one day towards the end of my time there. And it was an advert from the Telegraph looking for people for the Antarctic. And suddenly all those old thoughts came back. And I thought, is this possible, you know? It just seemed so remarkable to see an advert for your dream. And I talked to him. He said, oh, yeah, marvellous, you know, just go, right? So I wrote off and in due course got quite a glossy letter back from Milbank. And the next thing, I was being interviewed by Mr. Elliott and some very senior civil servants at the Crown Office. Which was another rather strange experience.
Why was that?
Well, I found it. It was, I realised it was very, very civil service, but it was strange in that, you know, in those days one put one's best suit on. And about the only tie I had was my old school tie, my old civilian tie. And I walked into this room and said, "Oh, is it jolly good? I see you're an old civilian." He said, "Did you play rugger?" I said, "Yes." Because it was a very good rugby school, was Queen Elizabeth's at Wakefield. Still is. And most of the interview was more about rugger. And then Elliot got his oar and started talking about climbing a
so
bit.
So who was asking you about rugby then?
Oh, the civil servant.
Oh, right.
These seniors, these mandarins. Okay. Didn't seem terribly interested in the Antarctic.
And then Frank Elliott started to ask Chris about climbing.
He was quizzing me about my climbing career. Of course, by then I'd had several seasons in the Alps, you know, summer holidays. And yeah, I was a fairly experienced climber by this time. And I realised that the pretty well had me picked out for base all right from the word, because at base over with, this was why it wasn't a very successful base, because it was really badly situated for moving about unless you were a climber. But there were, that's beside the point. Anyway, that went well and I was told I could go.
Did you get the sense it was a serious interview, or was it just a formality?
Oh, I think it was a serious interview. Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't pack people off to the Antarctic without some thought. I think these guys were a lot cleverer than I took them for, you know. But certainly much more astute.
So they were sussing you out, were they, psychologically?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Mm. Can you think on your feet and all that sort of thing? Yeah. But by that time, I was fairly used to responsibility, because a bit of engineering I'd done as a site engineer, you know, carried a lot of responsibility with it, and I was used to handling, you know, a lot of grown men. So, yeah, and climbing gives you a lot of these attributes as well. So,
medical?
Oh, the medical was no... I mean, they sent you for a very good medical, of course. Yeah, no problem passing that. I've always been lucky in having... What's the cliche? Robust, good health.
We're talking about the summer of 57, aren't we, at the present?
Yeah.
And you were then told you were sailing in October, 57?
Yeah. They actually took me on board almost immediately, because I think I said it seemed a little bit of an amateurish outlook, the way things were organised. And... they asked me to go, as I was available, they asked me if I would go and travel around and visit a lot of the firms who were supplying equipment for the trip. So I went down to the south coast a lot. Well, nearly all the firms seemed to be on the south coast. I'm going to visit Todd Boat, who provided a lot of our small boats, and talk to them about repairing fiberglass boats, which I knew nothing about. And also down to the people who are supplying the outboard engines and the likely ins and outs of operating these in ice. And just generally go around picking up information.
So it was more a case of you learning from them than you telling them what you wanted?
Oh, yeah. But it all turned out to be extremely useful. And it was...
How do you mean?
I think, you know... I didn't realise at the time, but small boats were... to play a very, very important part on Danco Coast Base because of the difficulties of travelling. And they became our major method of transport. And they do take a hell of a bashing, as you can imagine, down there. So knowing how to repair them and how to deal with the engines and things is all extremely useful.
So you were learning stuff on the South Coast, which you used later?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Well, it wasn't regular practice to send somebody off for a couple
of
days.
No, I think that might have just been an opportunity that presented themselves to my masters. And thought, oh, this is a good chance, you know. I've no doubt we would have managed anyway, but it would have been a slower learning process.
Yeah. Maybe it was an experiment as well to see whether that was a worthwhile project.
Possibly.
That they might have repeated later.
I mean, it gave a very pleasant tail end of the summit. I mean, just travelling around, fancy free, expenses paid. Yeah, enjoy it.
But October was looming and the departure date. How did he get to the Antarctic?
But on the Shackleton.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that was, in a sense, that was the biggest adventure of all. Because I certainly never done a long, apart from Channel ferries, I'd never really been to sea at all. You know. Yeah.
Tell me about the Shackleton in 1956-57. What was it like?
Well, at first it looked, we arrived with various people at Southampton looking for this boat, and the guy at the dock gate said, "Oh, go down such a wharf, you know." And he says, "You can't miss it because there's a big ship next to it." The big ship was the Queen Elizabeth, the old Queen Elizabeth. It was absolutely enormous. And I thought, well, that's big. Well, where's ours? You know? And there was some docky passing by. We asked him, he said, "Down there." We looked up the edge. It looked absolutely minute sitting. And it was literally moored next to the Queen Lizzie. Anyway, we got on board, really. It wasn't as small as all that. But it was quite a small ship. But it was a very nice ship with a Shackleton. It was a very unlike a lot of the ships that he used in the Antarctic. It was quite a beautiful, elegant ship. It's a nice shape, you know. And when we first got on board, you knew nobody, of course. Yeah. There wasn't a single person. Although there was a chap who'd been at school with me. But I didn't remember him, and he didn't remember me. Trying to think of his name now. Can't remember his name. He lived then in Blackpool. But I'll think of it later. Anyway, we just spent the first hour or two getting to know each other. They all looked... We were all terribly young, you know. And this is what, when you looked at them, they all looked terribly... very young to be going off on a big adventure.
Well, you were 23, 24?
I was one of the older ones. Yeah. Very much so, yeah. I mean, a lot of them was almost straight out of school, certainly straight out of university, you know. And but there were a bunch of likely lads. So, of course, we all went straight back ashore, went to a pub, thinking it might be our last time in a pub ever. We all finished up on the Queen Elizabeth, because we met some of the crew of the Queen Elizabeth who invited us back there. So we were all fairly thick-headed by the time we sailed it. We didn't sail all that early because all the bigwigs came down from London to see us off. You know, a bit of ceremony and thing.
So would Fuchs have been amongst those bigwigs? Or was he already in the Antarctic?
He'd be down in the, doing the, he'd be down at Halley Bay by then.
Transantarctic expedition.
No, he'd actually be on the crossing by then. Mm. A full year before.
Were you aware of that?
Oh, yes.
You'd been following it, had you?
Yeah, yeah. And then eventually we set off, you know. I mean, quite a lot of the people who were going, the parents had come down, but I'd asked my parents not to come. I don't know why. But they didn't. I said my farewells at Wakefield Station. So there were lots of tearful farewells, people waving bye-bye, and off we went down Southampton Sound and Southampton Water. And... yeah, it was all pretty exciting, really. So we spent a long time on that first afternoon and evening, just leaning over the side, watching England receding in the distance and becoming smaller. And the next day, we're down channel, and the bad weather came, and the next few days, we're all sick as dogs. But we gradually, as one does, you get used to it, and the next thing, a week later, you're down in the... well into the Atlantic in good weather and the sunshine. And then it became a magic mystery tour, really. I absolutely loved the journey down the Atlantic. You know, the steady rhythm of a boat just cruising a long way. I was doing, 10 knots? No more than 10 knots all the time. But beautiful weather, sitting out on the deck at night with somebody playing a guitar and looking up at the stars. And it just seemed... Well, it went on for 6 weeks before we landed, but it seemed to go on just forever. And I can't imagine why people want to go place in aeroplanes now. I mean, I would love to go on another long voyage like that. You know, it's just wonderful.
Did he have duties to perform on ship?
Well, they tried to keep us busy, you know, because we're a lot of young lads, you know, with really nothing to do except eat three times a day and drink at night. So they get some chipping paint, you know, the classic on any ship. But as it happened, fate took a hand. We were only about 5 days out when the doctors on board diagnosed the first cases of Asian flu, which, if you look in the record, 57 was the great Asian flu epidemic in Britain. And the crew must have picked it up quite a bit earlier from somewhere, because it didn't affect any of us at all. None of the FIDs were affected, but virtually all the crew but the captain got it. So we finished up doing running everything. You know, FIDs were steering, FIDs were cooking, FIDs were running the engine. So the course came rather erratic after that. But we just kept the ship going, you know. And event, by the time our first stop was Montevideo, by which time all the crew had recovered, you know. So it was quite interesting. Yeah.
Well, I've come across that before.
Yeah.
Interesting story, thank you.
Yeah. Because I, being an engineer trained, I studied engineer's watch, you know, for about 4 weeks, I should think.
Night watch or day watch?
Well, they're on shifts.
On shifts, yeah.
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 Yeah. Which, it was no great. I mean, all you had to do was be in the engine room. I mean, those engines just keep thumping away, thumping out power. So long as everything's oiled and greased and there's plenty of fuel going in, nothing happens. It's actually very, very hot going through the tropics in the engine room. Always glad to get out of there. But, again, another interesting experience. Yeah.
Tell me about Port Stanley when you got to it. What were your impressions of Port Stanley?
I thought we'd arrived on the west coast of Scotland, to be honest. That's... I mean, did you arrive by sea when you went there?
No.
If you do...
Oh, yeah, I didn't go to Stanley, though, but we did go by sea from Ushuaia.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, you can smell the Falkland 100 miles out, can't you, the peat smoke? I mean, you really can. But I thought, yeah, it's just like a little stone away or somewhere like that, really. And all the people of Scots extraction... very primitive place. I mean, it must be a very different place now. I mean, there was no airport, there was nothing really. I mean, everything happened around the Port Stanley ship, which just zigzagged back and forth to Montevideo and back. So there were only strangers in Stanley about once a month. A very pleasant place, and we went duck shooting, and I immediately found out there were some crags on the island, so organised climbing. We had a game of rugby. The Shackleton played the Protector rugby. That was a brutal match, especially there's no rugby field on port. We actually played on the race course. And we went to dances, we went to governor's cocktail parties. Yeah, it was interesting. But all the time you were aware, you know, the serious business was about to start. I mean, we got kitted out with all our Antarctic gear and stuff like that, which was all pretty primitive, actually. I don't know what clothing's issued now, but apart from a windproof suit of double ventile, I mean, we had nothing specialist at all. I mean, it's mostly old army gear. But I take some of my climbing gear, like a duvet jacket and things of my own, you know. But, yeah, I was a bit surprised at how the poor quality of some of the gear. Very surprised when it came to use it, and how useless it was. But the essential stuff, like the windproof gear, was all made by Edgington's. I've actually still got my old sledging anorak and sleeping bags and things. Sleeping bags were superb. They were made, all that stuff was made by Edgingtons, the tents, everything. So that was good. But the place that before we got to Stanley, of course, Montevideo was the place we all liked. I mean, that really was like being abroad. You know, new language, new architecture. We thought Montevideo was a wonderful place. Really liked it. And the Montevideans loved us. I mean, straight away the local papers, El Scientificos, are in town. And everywhere you went, free drinks. And, yeah. Oh, they really liked you there.
I suppose by 57 they were getting into the routine of there being an annual call.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Two, one each way.
Well, we spent a lot of money there, you see. Mm. Yeah. But yes, it was a nice experience, that. And of course, I don't know if it still is, but because of the old Graf Spee's upper mast was still sticking out of the harbour, some way out, but they were there, and that was interesting, because we'd all seen the Battle of the River Plate. Yeah, like that. But we weren't there all that long. Long enough to water up and refuel, basically. Probably a week, 10 days at the outside. Then we were off to Port Stanley. But Port Stanley was good, and by then we started getting a better idea. It wasn't until I got to Port Stanley I was told I was going to be base leader.
Who told you?
Ship's captain.
Had he decided, or had it been decided?
Oh, no, I think it had been decided before that, and he would have just got a radio message. Yeah.
You don't think he was watching you whilst you were...
Possibly. He may have reported back. Possibly. I don't know.
Hmm.
I'll be guessing anyway. But... and then, of course, we got some idea. Up until then, we had no idea who was going to be on the base with you, because you'd met all these people on the boat, and there was the other parallel boat coming down the Atlantic about the same time with another load of guys. And I discovered that all the people I was going to be on a base with were actually on the Bisco. They weren't on the Shackleton, so they were going to be total strangers to me, which is one of the things I found a little odd,
mm-hmm.
You know. But there we are, that's the way it was done. And then we got the itinerary, you know, we were going to go to South Georgia first to resupply there, then to Sydney, then Admiralty Bay. I might have got this order a little bit wrong, can't remember. Then to Deception, and then down the peninsula, Hope Bay and so on. The trip out to Georgia was okay, it wasn't too rough. Because that can be a hell of a passage, as we found out later. But it was exciting going to South Georgia, because we'd all heard and read about it. And it's, I don't know if you went to South Georgia yourself, but it's a pretty exciting place to visit, really. Huge mountains straight out of the sea. And of course, it was still a very active whaling place then, in 57. Two big whaling station factories. So we sail around the corner into Gritvicar, and there's all these smoke and smell and big hairy giants with cleansing knives. Quite an eye-opener, that. And all these catchers scurrying to and fro, dragging dead whales in. And of course, we paid the usual visits to Shackleton's grave, which was quite moving. Had a few days there. I don't know, again, there was some delay. I think there's something wrong with the ship. Had to be corrected. So we got a bit of climbing in there, actually. Went up Mount Paget, which is good.
Had you taken all your own ropes then?
Oh, there's plenty of climbing gear around. I mean, it's mountains of it everywhere.
And it was all okay quality? You were
No, the climbing gear was good.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll come back to that later. It was one of the problems we had, is that restricted our movement was very up-to-date climbing gear. It was good quality, it was there, but there could have been more of it, you know. And we had to do a lot of ice climbing. But to be honest, I suppose a lot of it hadn't been invented, really. Things like modern pterodactyl axes and front point crampons and that sort of thing. But... you know, traditional climbing gear, plenty of it. Yeah. And we all wander around these whaling factories, Steve. They're very fascinated seeing a whale cut up. I mean, these are the real big jobs, sperm whales, you know. Amazing. And then we were off again on the way to... I suppose we'd be heading for Sydney Island first. Can't remember. But then we got into the ice. We saw it. We started seeing icebergs, and then we saw the pack ice for the first time. Just loose brass stuff at first. And we got in and out of Sydney all right. And then we came out, and then we had the first big adventure. because we were held fast for about 5 days. I don't know, Captain Brown, the skipper of the thing, he was very, very surprised by this. He said, this shouldn't be happening, you know, this time, this far north. Anyway, eventually he worked the ship out of it. And it was, by this time, it was fairly late in the evening. Not exactly dark, but poor light. And he was trying to catch up time. It was probably way too fast, I don't know. But they were zooming around the top edge of the ice. And so we were up down below playing bridge, actually. Must have been about 11 o'clock at night. And I thought, bloody God, off, bang, you know. And sudden silence. And then a lot of running feet. So that was better. And we'd actually... The story, we'd hit an iceberg. It wasn't, in fact, it was a big growler. But it tore a bloody great rip in the side of the boat, well below the waterline. And almost immediately she started going over. And the skipper straight away says, just got to lighten this thing and get it heeled over. So just started throwing all the cargo over the side. No messing. Deck hatches off, just everything, whatever it was, straight over the side. And then started using every pump on the ship to pump all the liquids over onto the starboard side. Port side. And eventually he managed to get this big tent, and it was big, wasn't it? 6, 10 foot long, you know. It wasn't a hole as such, it just ripped the plates so that, you know, if you imagine two edges, they were out of a line like that. Mm-hmm. But it was, I mean, it was just taking water at a phenomenal rate. By this time, all the holes were full of water, and all the lifeboats were over the side. Maydays had gone out, but he did eventually get the boat heeled right over, so this big tear was out of the water. And then they started, what do we do now? And it was decided by this. All this, I'm saying it in 5 minutes, we're talking a good 24 hours, which was really quite frightening. The good thing was the weather was good. It was almost flat calm. If there'd been any seas running at all, that ship would have gone straight to the bottom, no messing, you know. Absolutely no doubt at all about that. But it was flat calm. And by this time, the Mayday had been answered by a whale catcher, one of the little catcher boats, and had come alongside, and the skipper decided to get as many people off onto that as he could, which he did, which meant more for the Finns. But he asked one or two of us who got some engineering experience to stay on board, if we were willing, you know. And the idea was to get as much water out of this and try and build a cofferdam behind this big tear, which we did do. It was all a bit rough and ready. Work it up to your, certainly up to your waist in water at times, up to your neck in water, which is very cold water, might add. But eventually we made some sort of repair on it.
Well, just explain a bit more about the repair.
Well, what you do, a cofferdam, basically you build a wooden frame inside where the hole, bigger than the hole. And then we use some stuff called cement fondue, which is cement that will set in seawater and it will set underwater And it was just fortunate we had a lot of this stuff on board because it was in regular use at all the bases. So we had tons and tons of it. And so this was mixed up and it was all packed into this dam, this coffer. And once that had set, it was still leaking because you can't do this job neatly. But it would allow the boat to move. And the idea was then that we would go very, very slowly to back to South Georgia, where they got a dry dock. We also put the traditional thing for any ship that's got a hole is a mat over the side. You know, use a big tarpaulin or something like that, and you get it right underneath the boat and wriggle it back with rope until it's over the hole. And the idea, any water pressure pushes it into the hole or the gap. And these two things together made an effective repair. But all the time, by this time, quite a lot of time had gone by. We're probably up to about 10 days or so. During which time the boat had just been sitting there, and fortunately the weather had remained good. And then out of the blue came, you know, the Protector. It had come hot foot all the way from Cape Town. It had in fact been in Cape Town having repairs done. And they got this news that this, you know, the Protector was our ship, you know, it looked after the Antarctic. And it just came absolutely flat out from Cape Town in 10 days, which is, I think that made some sort of record. The skipper said he just about burnt the engines out, the B-ray on the red line all the way, but they got there. And then they just took over, of course they had experts on board, you know. You know, the Royal Navy always have experts. I mean, they are wonderful. And they straightaway put divers over the side and they inspected this repair. They said, oh, we could do better than that. Then they produced all sorts of wonderful gear that they have on Royal Naval ships. And they had this big, I remember, this thing called a bolt gun, which fires threaded bolts into metal explosively. Just go bang, a bit like a nail gun. But you know, a big bolt threads itself into that, and they just put a ring of this all the way around this repair. Then they cut a big piece of plate steel to match all it and drilled holes to match all the bolts. Then they just bolted the whole thing with a sort of sausage of canvas and putty and all sorts of masticky material.
This is also slightly above water.
But they got it healed over again, yeah. Bolted it all up. They said, yeah, that'll get you to South Georgia. Because the skipper, for some reason, decided he was going to go to South Georgia backwards to keep the pressure off this thing, you know. But anyway, the Protector's guy said, no, turn it round, go a bit faster. But we went very slowly, about 5 knots. And we got it by this time, yeah, it worked. And we got it to South Georgia. The Protector also took all the people off the catcher onto the Protector. So the Protector and the Shackleton sailed off together, saying thanks to the catcher. We were very, very glad to see
that. What nationality was the whale catcher?
It's Norwegian.
Right.
Yeah. We were glad to see them, I'll tell you. Really. The more we saw you. It's a funny thing. It's the only time I've ever been shipwrecked. If it was being shipwrecked. And it's a horrible, lovely feeling. I mean, you are frightened. Make no mistake about it. I think everybody is terrified, you know. But you have to keep thinking. When you see someone else there, you know, straight away you know you're not going to drown. Because if this goes to the bottom, you can get on that one. So everything is a million times better. You know, so we were glad to see that. I mean, they are tiny things, those whalers. If we'd all got on it, it probably sunk with the sheer weight. But it didn't. And
so how long did the whole episode take, would you say, from hitting the iceberg to making it to South Georgia? 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
Yeah. But then, presumably, then you were stranded.
No, because they repaired the ship in South Georgia. We were stranded in South Georgia for, you know, threw the whole timetable out. Plus, of course, we'd thrown all the cargo. The cargo, of course, was what was going to replenish the bases. So, I mean, tremendous logistics problem. Anyway, they got the ship to South Georgia, and it would just go in their dry dock, only just. And they got it in, cut all the old plates out, just welded new ones in. It's good as new, you know.
In the space of a few days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then we went back to Port Stanley, by which time, because the airwaves had been full of what do we do, and basically that to reorder all that year's supply, because not everything went up with the side, but nobody knew exactly what, and it was almost impossible with all the mess to discover what had gone and what condition the stuff was, you know, boxes of food that had been underwater for 2 weeks, you know. So they just reordered everything. And somehow they got it out to the Falkland Islands in about a month. I don't know who organised that. These mandarins in London, presumably, who I didn't think much of. But
So you found yourself back at the Falkland
Islands? We were back at the Falkland. For Christmas. As it happened.
Before we talk about that, was there ever any kind of inquiry or...
Well... According to
court martial or something.
According to the Bible, there was, and this story is related in there,
in
but it's not related the way I've just told you it.
Right.
I think, in fact, Captain Brown never worked for the Falkland Islands Independence Survey again, and I think he was. One gets the impression what it says in there that. He hadn't been as careful as he could have been. But no, there were no loss of life, no serious damage anywhere, just one of those things. They're very underplayed in that book.
But is that your view as well? Do you think he was unlucky or was he foolish? Or
it's a very strange environment. I think the skippers of those ships that go down into the ice have an incredibly difficult job because they're not icebreakers. You know, they're just ice-strengthened ships. And I think they're probably asked to do more than the ships are designed for. They are very experienced mariners. Brown was and Johnson on the Biscoe. Johnson on the Biscoe was probably one of the most experienced ice navigators in the world at the time. And I think they have to take some very difficult... I mean, they've got to get to those bases. There are guys down there who are depending on them. And so they take shortcuts in order to get there.
Well, Brown was already delayed.
Was already delayed when he hadn't expected... I mean, further down, they had more and more time on. As you know, if you go down the Lemaire Channel and start getting down into Marguerite Bay, they're going to meet ice. They know they're going to meet ice. If they go down to the Weddell Sea, they know. But sailing, you know, just out of the roaring 40s, you don't really expect to meet pack ice. Mm. But he did, and it held him up. So he was probably going faster than he should have done. And perhaps the lookouts weren't as good as they should have been. But it was, I mean, one that he ran into, it was just a bit of brash ice. But you get to know brash ice is dangerous stuff. It's like tungsten steel. I wouldn't like to blame him for anything. I think they've probably been a bit harsh there.
Was there any kind of discussion about who was to blame amongst the FIDs at the time when you were back at Stanley?
No, we were 100% with the crew. By this time, the ship's officers were all British, but they were all bloody good. They really were. All the crew were Shelties, you know, from the Falkland Islanders, and they were just absolutely first-class natural seamen, you know. I mean, they were great guys. And I would find it very hard, and I think everybody else felt the same, to blame these guys for anything. You know, they were little gods to us. They were, you know, great guys, totally reliable, who would do the right things, you know. They were the odd one, like the cooks, who were the first into the lifeboat. No, they were great guys. Never really talked about it very much. Mm. We'd all been very frightened. We were very glad to be alive, to be honest.
So yeah. Did you think, did your life flash before your eyes at some point?
Not exactly.
You didn't think you were going to die.
We realised we'd be okay if the weather stayed good. If the weather turned bad, and we'd already met some fairly rough... I mean, you're just out in the roaring 40s there. It's a bad, bad place to be. And if the weather had got bad, as later we saw it, I mean, 18 months later coming out, we met the really bad weather. We all thought we were going to die then without any accidents. And one, as I say, once that whale got there, we all felt okay. Yeah, no one didn't think we were going to die then. Well, we knew we weren't.
So you had a rather unexpected Christmas on,
yeah,
on the Falklands. Yeah. What was Christmas like in the Falklands?
It's good. And it's when they have their, the time they use their racetrack, so they have the races and everybody has parties, and they all realise we'd just had a bad experience, so people went out of their way to invite us to meals out and things like that. And I know the chap who was in the new... Elliot, the sex fiddler, retired by then, and we had a new chap called Green.
Johnny Green.
Who I got on extremely well with. And in fact, he and his wife invited me to spend Christmas with them, which I did do. That's another relationship I kept up for quite a long time, because he went to work for Outward Bound. And I had friends that worked at Outward Bound, and so I kept coming across Johnny, you know, who remained a good friend. But then I don't know what happened to him. He just seemed to vanish. Mm. No idea. I certainly was seeing him in the 70s when he was bursar at Abu Dhabi, out of Barn School. And then it just seemed, I don't know what happened to him. Which is a pity, because he was a really nice guy. Very lively bloke. With an incredibly dishy wife. Yeah. So, yeah, Christmas, okay. And then all the stuff began to arrive, you know. And then we all had to work jolly hard sorting all this gear out, where it was going to go. And then we set off again. But not via South Georgia this time. It was straight south to the bases. But I think the first place we went was Admiralty Bay.
I presume it was quite a warm welcome, because they'd been delayed there, hadn't they?
There were people who were expecting to go come out. I don't think they were too worried, because of course when you go down into the ice, it's only just really the spring or very early summer, so there's still quite a lot of time to play with. I don't think they were too anxious. They might have been anxious about whether they're going to get any more fags and booze and mashed potatoes.
Letters, letters from home.
Letters. Yeah, this is what everybody always wants. The bags of letters. Yeah. It's amazing how when you only get post once a year, how important it becomes. So, yeah, then, so we got down into the ice proper and we saw the mainland of the Antarctic. And I mean, that was very exciting. Yeah. I suppose all these cruise ships that go down there now, this is what they all get excited about. But it's just an amazingly beautiful place, isn't it? I can't imagine anybody not being excited seeing the Antarctic Peninsula for the first time.
What did you make of Danco Island when you finally got there? Your home for the next 18 months?
Well, my mountaineer's eye was... Well, it had been at work for some days going down that coast. I thought, this is not going to be an easy place to work. You go down with the idea of charging along with the dog sledge, or you did in those days. I mean, all everyone had to do was get behind some dogs, you know. And I'd learned early on that we're going to have no dogs at Danco. Mm. And I thought, yeah, question, why not? Why can't we have dogs? So, well, the moment I went down the Le Maire Channel, I realised that utterly useless dogs were going to be, you know. But I thought Danco is an incredibly beautiful place. I mean, it must be one of the most beautifully situated huts in the Antarctic. It's a phenomenal place. Did you ever visit one?
No, absolutely not.
I mean, it's just surrounded.
I've been down that area.
I mean, it's been down the Lemaire Channel. I mean, it's just surrounded by all these mountains. I mean, this straight about. I mean, my description was always the Alps by the sea. Mm. But the island itself is tiny. You know, it's a very small island. And it's also covered with bloody penguins. And in the summer, the stench is horrendous. So that was a bit of a dump. But we were welcomed by Dick Foster and his party. There were quite a big group staying there when we got there, because like all Antarctic, they get lots of summer visitors. There must have been about, I don't know, 15 or 16 people when we got there. But we only wintered 5. But there were, some of them were just people down just for a couple of months to do a particular job, you know. Anyway, Dick did the handover and showed us around, and we thought, this is going to be our home. The other big surprise, because we were brought up with stories of how everybody lives in these constant blizzards on these Antarctic bases, and the weather was absolutely wonderful. We had about 2 months of cyclonic weather, just blue skies and wall-to-wall sunshine for days after day after day. It was amazing. Yeah, I remember actually walking around sunbathing. And somebody says it won't last.
They were right.
Yeah. And of course, you're very busy when you go to a base. You know, all the stuff, I mean, you work really hard getting all the stuff ashore. So, yeah, you're working, I don't know, 15, 16 hours a day, you know, really hard labour. Still living on the ship then, of course. And you realise how much stuff you need to run a base. I remember thinking, the first mate said, right, tomorrow we're going to shift coal. I mean, we've got about 40 blokes doing nothing but carrying sacks of coal for a whole day. You know, I mean, I don't know how many tonnes of it. Must have been about 400 tonnes of coal, you know.
So what did the Shackleton have? Did it have a little dinghy to get?
No, it had a... I'll show you a photograph. I'll show you a photograph how it does. A thing called a scow, a lighter.
Right.
Like a big barge. And they lash the ship's boat to it. This used to be an immaculate... it's been an immaculate album, really. It's just got four...
Looks well thumbs these days. Yeah.
So that's a scow, you see. Everything blown from the ship. There's
so there's a derrick.
A derrick into there, then the lash of the motor boat, and it comes inshore. Then everything is humped by hand.
Through the waves,
there's
yeah.
No easy way. No mechanical aids at all.
So this is Dengo Island with the steep sheer cliffs.
Yeah. I mean, it's just surrounded. That's a view from the bay straight across to Rondé Island.
Mm.
But that's an offshore island. I'll find you the photo if you want to see them. Well, no, that's Deception Island.
Well, that's Deception, is it?
That's
yes.
Yeah.
With the V-shaped entrance, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll look at the pictures later on, Duncan, because they don't come out terribly well on the wires.
No. So, okay. So, yeah, it's very hard work when you arrive at the base. And, of course, if you're lucky, you only have it to do at the base, then you get off and somebody else has to do the rest. But we'd already visited Admiralty Bay, Deception Island, Sydney Island and Hope Bay, so we were getting quite used to this humping.
So what surprised you about Denker? Were you surprised by its location or by the size of the...
The big thing was the location, yeah. I just thought, who on earth got the idea of putting a base here? And, of course, this was true. I mean, it only lasted really as an effective base for what... Two years. I mean, we closed it down a year later. Because it proved impossible, really, to do the job properly. I mean, all bases have a variety of jobs. You've always got the weather and the tides and things to measure. It's just ongoing job. But our major task at Danco, of course, or the task that was given to me, were ground fixers for the big aero survey that had been done 2 years earlier. the British government, for some reason, decided they were going to map the whole Antarctic Peninsula properly. And so they got... what's the big...
Huntings
to go down. And they set up a base at Deception Island. And they just flew all summer, just trip after trip, row after row, and finished up with literally millions of photographs, runs of photographs, you know, continuous run.
Meaning
but like, which are absolutely useless without having accurate fixes, because, you know, they're not straight lines. And so our job was to find locations that you could recognise on the photograph that were accessible on the ground where you can do 17-star astrofixes, you know, Ordnance Survey standard fixes, and do a bit of filling in with plane tabling. And the obvious place for these are small islands, so you can get the fix easily, and mountaintops. Hence, the need of a mountaineer in charge.
Had you had any training in surveying? Or was that somebody else's job?
No, we had another geographer who was a trained surveyor. But he quickly showed me how to do 17-star astrophysics. That wasn't a problem. And, of course, I was a geographer, so it was sort of second nature. And the mathematics of it I'd got through my engineering training. That was, fairly straight. Like most of the technicalities are fairly straightforward. The problem is getting to these places. And I straight away realised that all these mountains with nice clearance were going to be bloody difficult to climb. Plus, you get to the sea in the Antarctic and you get an ice cliff. And this is what comes back to the climbing equipment. With modern climbing equipment, I could have been up and down those cliffs, no trouble at all. But with old-fashioned equipment, it's, you know, only one or two places where you could make it.
So what were you missing? What were you lacking in those days?
Oh, good modernised climbing equipment.
Such as?
When I say lacking, that's not quite fair. I mean, it just hadn't been invented. I mean, how much do you know about climbing?
Well, modern just climbing. Explain to...
I mean, modern climbers now climb vertical ice faces. Absolutely. I mean, it's an absolute norm thing to do. Those things called pterodactyl, which are hooked ice axes, which... And they use crampons, which have got front points on, so they just kick them into a vertical face. And they just ding, 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 walk up. But, I mean, that technique hadn't been invented. The equipment hadn't been invented in the 50s. And
so every fix you were able to establish was hard won, was it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, what you were always looking for were breaks in ice cliffs. This is why Cape Recluse was established, because there was... what was thought to be an easy route onto the plateau. It proved not to be easy, in fact, and it was only ever used once, because the idea was to do a big trip from Hope Bay to Danco Coast, which was, in fact, done. Wally Herbert and some of them did it. But it took them... It was under 300 miles, and it took them about 80 days. Which is a phenomenal long time. And the way was prepared by Foster and Company, who, you know, got up from Cape and found the route up. So a lot of the work had been done for them. Yeah. And it still took them. So, you know, it was reckoned. They were hoping for a regular route. And it just proved to be impossible. Mm. Well, not impossible, too difficult.
So if you wanted to knock off a mountaintop not far from Danco Base Hut, who would do it and how long would it take you? I mean, who would you go? You wouldn't go solo, would you?
Oh, no, no. Well, you'd take the surveyor with you for a start. I mean, basically...
Who was the surveyor?
A lad called David Evans.
And was he an experienced climber?
Not really. Not really. But he was young. I mean, all the lads used to come with me. I mean, they all climb up. I mean, it wasn't if you climb in like a day climb from here with a light sack, you'd all the survey. I mean, a theodolite's heavy. Mm. And later on we got a thing called a telerometer, which made the surveying easier, but it required car batteries to fire it up. Imagine climbing a mountain with a couple of car batteries.
And you did that, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Several times?
Several times.
Were there any close calls in that climbing regime?
Not really. No, no. The climb in itself was straight. It wasn't hard work, but it was straightforward enough.
But the weather would be very changeable. I mean,
it was always about the weather. Mm. I mean, you planned to go to a peak, which you wanted as many points as possible. A bit like the Ordnance Survey used to do with their trig points. You want to be able to see as many as possible from any point you visit. And we were doing it precisely the same sort of thing. But you climb up there and get up there, then the clag would come in. And for a star fate, you've got to have a clear sky. Mm. We're prepared to work through the night. And what we'd usually do is go and camp on a peak. Take camping gear up there and camp.
And wait.
But there's a limit to how long you can wait, you know. So it was very, very frustrating.
You know. So were you or were you not succeeding in getting the kind of fixes you needed to...
The ones we got were good, but there were a lot of gaps. I don't think they ever produced the quality of maps for the Antarctic Peninsula that they... The odd ones I've seen have got an awful lot of gaps on them, you know. But with modern conditions and helicopters, I mean, if you can helicopter up there... I mean, once or twice we got the protectors to fly their helicopters up to places for us, and that was easy. Pile up, getting the job. But in those days, the helicopter, the protector flew, had enormous limits placed on their use in the Antarctic. I don't think they were allowed to fly above 2,000 feet and this sort of thing. But the peninsula was 7,000 foot high in places. So it was already the very edges they were able to fly. But when you could use them, I mean, you could do a month's work in a morning, you know. Mm-hmm. It was terrific.
So the helicopter would take you up there and hover around waiting whilst you took...
Well, the skipper would say, you know, are you going to be able to do it quick? Mm. I mean, if it was really good weather, you know, we'd say, OK. I mean, we'd prefer to do this job at night, the actual surveying.
In the dark?
In the dark, yeah. Much easier if you got a clear. So what you possibly do is get the chopper to fly up there with your camping gear, set up a camp, and say, you know, come back tomorrow for us, or 2 days, or whatever. But that wasn't the protector's main job, and I think they were always bending the rules to help us. So it didn't happen that often. But it happened often enough to realise that that's where the future lay for surveying in the Antarctic, and I guess that's how it's all done now.
So would you know and the protector know that these helicopters were breaking the rules by flying too high?
Oh, I'm not suggesting they ever flew too high. I'm suggesting they were operating right on the limit.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I don't think we would have asked them to. I mean, hellfire, it's a dangerous enough place, the Antarctic, without doing that. And these are needed for other things. I mean, the Protector only had one helicopter. They didn't have a fleet of them, you know. And if it got bust, you know, a lot of more important things could possibly have fallen by the wayside. Yeah.
So all in all, it was a frustrating time, was it, trying to survey?
Yeah. I mean, looking back after what I'm looking back 50, getting over 60 years, a lot of things in the Antarctic are frustrating. I mean, yeah, I think so. I think what outsiders don't appreciate is how unadventurous most of the time is. I mean, I suppose like a lot of people, when I came back, I got people, you know, round tables and inviting to come on, give you lunch and give us a talk. I did a lot of talks to people about life in the Antarctic. And the thing I always used to stress was how probably more than 75% of your time on a base is taken up with just living. The ordinary things, you know. Everything we take for granted here. You want a glass of water, you go to the tap, turn the tap on. In order to do that on a base, somebody's probably got to spend about 8 hours a day humping bloody great lumps of ice to be melted down, you know. You know, we go to the laboratory there. There are no flushing labs. Well, there might be now, I don't know, but there certainly weren't then. It was just a chemical laboratory, and every day that had to be emptied somewhere. And, you know, everything is difficult, you know, and takes a lot of time. And then you add to that fairly constant, very bad weather. I think that thing that gets every... I mean, if you'll know if you've been... What gets you down there is that damn wind. That constant howling of the wind. It becomes very depressing, actually, that. Yeah. I don't know how many people have gone balmy down in the Antarctic. It must be quite a few, I suspect.
Did you get depressed?
Hmm?
Did you get depressed?
Not in the modern terms of the word, no. As basically, I felt it was my job to cheer everybody up, you know, so I wasn't allowed to be depressed. But I used to get the blues occasionally, yeah, of course I did. You devise little rules, don't you? I remember having a talk when we're coming out after them, talking with John Paisley and George McLeod and one or two others. They'd all been basically in this, just in sitting having a beer and comparing what we found difficult or easy being a base leader. And they'd all done what I did of developing strategies to deal with various things, but they'd all been different strategies. There was no common thread at all. But they'd all been equally effective.
What was your strategy?
As few rules as possible. But the rules that you have got to be clearly understood, and everybody agrees that they are good rules. So I thought only that way are they going to obey them. And I mean, some things were quite difficult to do. I mean, I don't know whether it's still the same now, but there was an awful lot of booze on British bases. Technically, it was rationed, but it was a ration that I have never got anywhere near the entire life. And some people, everybody had a different strategy for handling booze. I mean, the favourite thing was a Saturday night bash and then nobody has a drink for the rest of the week. And I thought, you know, it's a bit daft, that, because sometimes people need a drink because they're a bit pissed off, you know, to be honest. So they can't wait till Saturday night. So I said, anybody can have a drink any time. On the understanding that you mustn't drink on your own. If you go to the bar for a drink, you've got to offer to get anybody else who wants one. So in other words, there's going to be a little drinking party. That was that. And the other second rule was nobody ever gets really drunk unless it's a special occasion like Christmas Day or Midwinter's Day. But otherwise, drunkenness is out. And that worked very well for us. I mean, most evenings someone would say, I think I'll have a dram. Anybody else want one? And that would be it. It might be someone's birthday or whatever. And say, let's have a little party. So we'd have a little party. And, of course, Christmas Day and Midwinter's Day. And that worked fine for us. I don't ever remember anybody ever getting drunk on my base. And certainly nobody ever got nasty with drink. In fact, I don't think ever anybody got nasty with anybody else.
Let's pause for a moment and
right.
Reconvene shortly.
Yeah.